Hi, it's Judy. This is the second episode of my thesis podcast, Listening to Fire Knowledges. This episode includes a number of conversations about surviving wildfire events and living in their aftermath. My heart and thoughts are with those who have lost something in a disastrous wildfire event, including with my aunt and uncle who lost their home in the California Camp Fire in 2018. I know conversations about wildfire disasters can be challenging to hear, so I hope you can take care of yourself and listen when you're ready. Thanks for being here.
Well, I love the dry heat. I love the smell of the earth. I love the blue and gold, the blue sky and the gold grass. I love the orchards. They always seem so beautiful in almost sort of a biblical way, these orchards with all this fruit hanging, the gift of that and the gift of its warmth, its welcoming warmth. And maybe it's the smell of the pines too, that resinous kind of perfume. I mean, you come from a different place, and so you would have your experience of this place too. My name is Sharon Thiessen. I'm a professor emeritus of creative writing at UBC's Okanagan campus. I've been a writer, a poet, a critic, and an editor for many decades in the Canadian, BC, and Cascadian worlds, Cascadia being the bioregion that encompasses most of BC, including the Okanagan. And it's an extremely unstable geologically, prone to fire, tsunami, earthquake, volcano, flood, avalanche. And so it's a landscape that's very vibrant, very beautiful, but also dangerous, and it creates challenges for sure. So in this challenging, beautiful bioregion, I've been living for most of my life. Living in Vancouver, I was always aware as a writer of being in a kind of different zone from the rest of Canada. It seemed that we writers, a lot of us poets in Vancouver, had deeper aesthetic and poetic connections with our counterparts in the States, in California. But the quote-unquote rest of Canada was not involved in these kind of poetics. And so there was always this sort of east-west stretch or difference. So there was a sense of a kind of not belonging. And okay, so then what do you belong to? And so here is this very, very prominent geology, geography, landscape. But I always had a soft spot for the interior. I spent probably about 10 years of my young life living in the Kamloops and Vernon areas, and always wanted to come back. And I appreciated the spectacular landscape on the coast, but my body, my heart, was here. So when we started coming back here, I just feel so at home because, you know, I could smell it. I recognize the weeds that, you know, like when you're a little kid, you're closer to the ground and you're seeing the weeds and all that stuff. And so it's, oh, those weeds, right? And and it still is. It still is my the place of my heart and my deepest being is this landscape.
You sat down with another student, Amy Thiessen, almost 2 years ago, who's another student in the AMP lab like I am, to record a digital edition of your poem, The Fire, which was really wonderful to listen to. And you talked about your experience of living through the 2003 Okanagan Mountain Park fire. And I'm really grateful that you're willing to revisit these experiences again. And Yeah, so it sounds like that was the year that you moved to Kelowna, was the year of this fire. I wonder if you, if you're comfortable talking about it again, talk about what you remember of that fire happening and the experience of having to be evacuated at that time.
Yeah, so we moved into this, as I was mentioning before, subdivision. We were so thrilled to be able to live in this beautiful house that was new. Surrounding the house, like on every side of the house, was forest. And it was beautiful. So we had these two dogs. I'd take them to walk every morning. We'd go. There was trees, forest, coyotes. There was a little lake. It was really, really hot for a couple of weeks prior to the fire starting. But we didn't mind. We liked it. Can I just
Please
read this
do.
This little paragraph? The subdivision was called South Ridge, and there were about 40 houses off a T-shaped roadway. A park, quote-unquote, was made somewhere in the middle, and a new road was already being built just above ours. Hundreds of acres of woods, streams, and meadows flourished just beyond where the roads ended, having not yet succumbed to the inferno that would engulf the landscape. A couple of months later, that's when we first moved. June and her husband David lived a little farther up the hill, while we were closer to cherry orchards and large old properties that until then had been somewhat out of town. Deer hunters still stalked the woods not far from our houses back in 2003, when I first met June. Late one night, after a lengthy heat wave, we were awakened by a thunderclap, and in the morning a plume of smoke could be seen rising into the sky to the south. This plume, by the time June and I got to the beach that afternoon for our regular swim, was starting to develop an ominous anvil shape on its eastern edge. 2 days later, you could hardly see or breathe for the smoke, and there were reports of houses burning in a residential area far to the south. But for some reason, we weren't quite sure about that, even though evacuation alerts were being handed out in neighborhoods farther down from us. We tried to stay calm as falling embers burned holes in our lawn chairs. Paul, as my husband, Paul and I had made a casual arrangement just in case with friends who lived in Penticton should the worst come to the worst, which we didn't think was possible. Surely the fire wouldn't jump the blocks wide clearing where the big power lines were. By the time I think they started trying to put it out, it was out of control, and the wind was blowing. And the wind is the worst thing that can happen with a fire. And fire, when a fire gets really bad, as this one did, it became the worst level of fire you could have, rank 6. People even farther north than us were getting evacuation alerts. So we're just saying, oh, well, they must think we're going to be okay then, right? Because we didn't get one. But it got to a point where I was starting to get really nervous. And I was starting to kind of think maybe we should pack some things up. And so to go through that process is horrible. And so we phoned our friends in Penticton, and Paul said, you go, and I'll stay here and kind of, you know, hold the fort. And it was that afternoon. It was pitch dark from smoke. And driving down, there was the whole side of Okanagan Mountain Park. It was just a flame. And now, you know, I still remember that side of Okanagan Lake used to be just forested, completely forested. So that's what happened. I went down to our friends in Penticton. Paul went down to June and David's for dinner.
Who lived in that's nearby.
Nearby. And so they were eating dinner inside, and June went out to kind of see how things were, and there was a fire coming right down the hill.
Oh my gosh.
So Paul jumped in the car, drove back to our place, and I had, you know, packed some stuff, and he was throwing, and the police were going up and down saying, get out right now, right now, right now. So
And you hadn't received an evacuation alert prior to that? Wow. No. It was moving that fast.
It was moving that fast. And also, I think that the authorities didn't really even know we were still there because it was such a new development. We probably weren't even on the map.
Wow.
But so he had to drive down through what was then an old quarry, is now called the quarry. And June and David came, and they decided to go back to White Rock. And they stayed overnight at our friends in Penticton in their car. There was a period of time when they thought the whole town was going to go up in flames. The whole town. And there was still so much chaos, and the fire still wasn't really out for quite a long time. It was the Winfield Fire Department, and I can still see the tracks of their boots in our little flower beds around the house. They had given up. The fire was coming. It was too hot. It was terrifying. They were going to die. You know, it was, they'd done everything they could, and the wind changed. And the wind changed and took the fire north to an area called Crawford and burned up most of the houses there. But ours were fine, left standing. But we didn't know that for a long time.
So when did you find out that, when were you able to return back to your house?
The fire department held a meeting in that big Trinity Baptist Church because they were not saying whose houses, what areas had burned and what hadn't, and so on. And but for some reason, we either weren't invited to that or didn't go, or I don't know, but there was one area that was really badly burned, Oka View and Kettle Valley and in there. And all those people were to sit in Trinity Baptist Church while whoever it was pointed out all the lots and on a map which houses had burned and which were still standing and which were damaged. And so can you imagine that meeting?
No. Do you remember anyone talking about fire danger before the fire?
Yeah.
Anyone who was living in the Okanagan in 2003 remembers the firestorm. It was a season stoked by drought. This fire started in a park where people had been warning of the accumulating fuels and fire danger for years, but little had been done. The Okanagan Mountain Park fire burned more than 25,000 hectares, caused 33,000 residents to be evacuated, damaged or destroyed 238 homes, and caused $200 million in damages. It was one fire of many in Firestorm 2003, a summer that sent a record high number of forest fires burning in British Columbia. A provincial review team was established after this fire season was over to evaluate the response to these fires and make recommendations for the future. The resulting Filmon report explicitly linked the severe wildfires of 2003 to the buildup of fuels caused by decades of fire suppression. Between then and the time I write this in early 2022, the Okanagan Valley has experienced even larger fire seasons. Here's Matthew Bourbonnais again. Do you have any specific fires that have happened in the Okanagan that you point to in, like, trying to explain, like, what our wildfire situation is here in the valley, or kind of examples that you use to think through how we live with wildfire and kind of what challenges are?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the Okanagan, the communities here have a lot of, like, experience with fire. You know, the 2003 Okanagan Mountain Fire, you know, was... it kind of was one of those fires, like if we look back over the last 20 years, it was kind of one of those fires that kind of put fire as like a big threat to communities kind of back in people's minds, I think. You know, we lost a few hundred homes. There was, you know, thousands of people evacuated for over a month. And it's something that, you know, it's ingrained in like the mentality here in the Okanagan. Like you hear people who lived through it still talk about the 2003 fire. And if you go up into that area where it burned, You know, there's infographics, there's signs kind of talking about the fire and what happened. And so that's one that, like, people that have been here for a long time, they remember it.
It was unpleasant to understate it. Yeah, it was quite smoky and fiery and scary. And houses were being burned, and it was really kind of apocalyptic. And I remember seeing the fire, the smoke start when the fire first started, and I heard about the lightning strike and the fire started burning, and people were out looking at it, and it just kept burning northward, further northward, and started destroying homes. So yeah, it was quite a scary occurrence to happen. And it was still, and at the same time, there was some health risks there too. I was into different athletic events and so forth back then. That was when I was more into marathons and running and so forth. And it really interrupted my training schedule, which wasn't good. So either that, or I was going to just be smoking all day while I run through the smoke. I remember the smoke being so thick at times you couldn't see more than 20 feet through it. So my name is Daryl Spencer. I've been a registered professional forester since 1985. So it's been a few years. I've done fire management and planning and so forth, and amongst other things, in the Okanagan Valley for the past 20 years. My current role, I work for the government. I worked with the Forest Practices Board, who is a environmental watchdog for the province. So we look at various things that fall under the Forest and Range Practices Act and the Wildfire Act. Certainly there was fires, but not as predominant as, say, 2003 was like a fulcrum kind of point where fires seemed to take off for me anyway. But I think that fire, like I said earlier, alluded to earlier, it was like a launching point or staging point for more awareness with municipalities, the parks, and the government, that served as a bit of a wake-up call for, say, the City of Kelowna, BC Parks, and Ministry of Forests, and raise their awareness of the importance of managing interface fuels and so forth. That was a key thing there. And I mentioned all those homes were burned down. It was a situation where Okanagan Mountain Park, which is back then a Class A park, I think it still is, and Class A parks are left unto themselves to evolve ecologically. And so there's huge mats of pine needles and so forth on the forest floor up to, you know, 2 or 3 feet thick and gathering areas and so forth. So a lightning strike in that fuel, which is readily burnable and burns quite rapidly, started that fire, and all these homes were being developed adjacent to this park without the thought of fuel management. So that resulted in a lot of these homes burning up. So that was kind of a wake-up call for city planners and parks to start setting up interface and buffer areas and so forth to protect homes.
The night the fire started, our oldest, who's 20 now, it was a thunderstorm on a Saturday night, I think it was, or Friday night, and it woke her up. And I remember walking around, you know, holding her and trying to console her and get her to go back to sleep. And we saw these flashes of lightning, and I was thinking to myself exactly about this guy that was on his horseback in that area just a few weeks before that, and thinking, wow, you know, it's been so dry all summer, this is going to start something. And the next morning, yes, for sure, it had cleared off, and there was this wisp of smoke going right over our house. And it was this odd yellowy color, and it was just a thin sort of strip of smoke, if you will, and it was fairly high. And I thought, ah, man, it started. My name is Dave Gill. I'm a registered professional forester, and I work for West Bank First Nation, a company called Ntiitiik Resources, which is West Bank's forest management company. And we heard them on it. We could hear the helicopters and on the fire, and we thought that it would, you know, they'd bring it under control. But within a couple days, we realized it was much more than that. It wasn't long before, you know, people were starting to crowd on the streets around us and higher up on the hill behind us, just looking at this thing. And a few days later, we were told to leave. So yeah, that was the way I was initiated to fire in the Okanagan. And that in itself changed the way I thought about fire. From what I learned to, you know, on the ground, what I've been hearing from from people that live here rather than what I had learned in school. And, you know, from there we had the Filmon Report, and we had a lot of other, I guess for the most part, high-level reports that came out about fire, and that maybe we've been taking the wrong approach with fire for 100 years.
You know, more recently, just even the last few years, Mount Christie fire, White Rock Lake fire, again, fires that like really, really quickly came like right to our doorstep. These are fires that, you know, these aren't fires that like, it's kind of like, oh, there's an evacuation alert or, you know, you need to be kind of prepared. It was just kind of like pretty quickly, it was right there. And that's kind of the situation that we kind of have in the Okanagan, where, you know, really oftentimes really dry conditions that are really conducive to fire spreading quite quickly. And it's what we kind of should be expecting kind of moving forward is like really is more of that. Again, people lost homes. It disrupted a lot of people's lives. You're always trying to kind of take that into context. But those are examples you can point to that it's like this is what we should be expecting, and we need to kind of prepare better for that. From 2003 to now, like we look at this last year, you know, the heat dome, these extreme kind of weather conditions that regardless of where you are, if there are those kind of conditions, there is a good chance that if a fire happens, you're going to have a lot of problems. I think like, you know, yeah, definitely landscape management is a part of it. But also just kind of our legacy and our history of how we've managed this valley combined with, you know, how our climate is changing. It's kind of, you can see the progression now as you look back over the last kind of 20 years.
Like just hearing about that experience of really not having a lot of conversation about fire and then having this massive fire happen, I wonder how fire seasons since then have been for you. Do you hear more conversations happening about fire preparedness and fire smart? And also, what's it like been for you for these past fire seasons that have been bad again, to have to live through those kind of smoky summers again?
Smoky summers is, and it's true, I'm extremely anxious every summer. You know, we moved to Lake Country. I guess it felt like a new start or a fresh start, or to go somewhere where there hadn't been that kind of destruction and damage. So yes, smoky summers, the heat, the wind, extreme anxiety. And then it gets cooler in the fall and you kind of forget about it. And then it's, you know, then and everybody says, oh, it's not going to happen here. Or, oh, you know, they know enough about it now that they will make sure that, you know, there's protection. But anyway, last May, half of the fire departments from around the Okanagan were in our very neighborhood practicing putting out forest interface zone fires. This last summer, because we live, you know, in a place where we can kind of see up the lake, you know, I could see the smoke and at night you see the fire. There was that endless fire that was burning up there for about a month and a half.
There's a lot of work needed. Just speaking of the Okanagan Badlands here and the fire that they experienced last summer was quite devastating for the community, and the loss could have been a lot worse. But if you look at the landscape from about a kilometer from here, I'm on the north end of the reserve to the south end, which is probably at least 10 kilometers in length. Once you get off the lake, you get into an interface forest, and it's quite thick, very dead, decayed pine and fir. And I know they do fuel reduction projects, but you're talking 10, 20 hectares at a time, and you probably need 50,000 hectares to be done along the whole interface to make a difference. So, yeah, my name's Jeff Eustache. I'm a registered forest technologist. I'm from the Sip First Nation, just north of Kamloops, but I live and reside on the Okanagan Indian Band lands. And I work as the emergency program manager for IPO West Natural Resources Canada.
Before moving over to Natural Resources Canada more recently, Jeff had worked for the First Nations Emergency Services Society of BC since the mid-2000s. That's how I found his work. As head of the Fuel Management Department, Jeff supported First Nations communities in taking care of wildfire hazards on their land. This also included working on the Revitalizing Cultural Burning Project in 2019 with the BC Wildfire Service, the Bridge River Indian Band, and the Shakan Indian Band. This project provided funding for these First Nations communities to conduct cultural burns and document their Indigenous fire stewardship knowledge in videos, reports, and infographics. I'll put a link to those projects in the show notes. In all of my interviews, including this one with Jeff, we talked about much more than you'll hear in this podcast. But it was significant for me to hear Jeff, someone with extensive wildfire hazard management experience, reflect on living through the White Rock Lake fire last summer on Okanagan Indian Band land.
That fire that came through here last year, it started in Monty Lake, which is about, 30 kilometers from here. And when they kept on talking about it, I said, well, it's never going to get here. They'll knock it down over there somewhere. And next thing you know, we're getting evacuated. So I was pretty surprised that even how it came into the community, because there's some, what I thought would have been pretty good fire breaks. I was pretty surprised that it made it that far. We got kind of lucky. We're a little bit further away from where the fire actually was. We got displaced maybe three times over the summer, but some were displaced for probably most of the summer, and unfortunately some haven't been able to go home because they got lost their homes, right? So you can see the need for higher level landscape level treatments, and you can do the fuel reduction outside of the doorstep there, but once it starts rolling like it did, it takes a lot more than a 50-100 meter fuel treatment to stop that. So I think it's going to require a lot more aggressive fuel reduction treatments. I know my wife's family members, they actively go out, and it's only about, I would say, not even five kilometers from here. They would actively go out every spring and do some burning outside of their property. I'm fairly sure that resulted in a few of their structures being saved, because there's it didn't have that understory that could have ignited and swept through there. I was pretty surprised there was not a lot more losses along the valley here. Where it came down, it hit pretty hard, but I'm fairly sure that the burning practices of that family really helped, because they would go out in the forest. It wasn't just grass burning. They'd go up the hillside. And that really, I think, resulted in some protective measures for them. You know, you need to try and increase that more and more. Otherwise, you know, like I said, once it starts rolling that quickly, it's pretty hard to stop. Right. You actually can stop it.
Yeah.
I'm Gord Pratt, you know, a professional forester who works as an operations manager with Forest Enhancement Society, BC. And I'm just happy to be able to join you here today, Judy. I was actually on the Peachland fire back in 2012, I believe. You know, and I remember being in Kamloops that day, and it was one of those hot early September days where, you know what, you're starting to think you're past the fire season. And in many ways, but it was windy, super windy. And, you know, I actually remember having a conversation with a friend of mine who was pretty active with BC Wildfires. This isn't a good day. You know, if we get a start, it's going to be a problem somewhere, right? And, you know, sure enough, later that weekend, Peachland was on evacuation, and it started up, I believe, on the top end on the coke, and it ripped down through the community. It's hard to predict where it will happen, but every year we're learning more about where the piece of my philosophy is: reduce the fuels where there's likelihood of starts. And where's that fire behavior going to, and what's the typical weather going to move it towards? And that's where we need to do, right?
And I wonder if you could just introduce the FESBC for folks who might not know what that is, and talk about your role in this work now.
For sure. So the Forest Enhancement was formed by government back in 2016. It's really about good opportunity to invest back in the province, good stewardship projects going forward. And those stewardship projects are governed by our what we have five primary purposes. And
the Forest Enhancement Society of BC has been a major funder of fuel management projects. I spoke with foresters I interviewed extensively about fuel management. This refers to work to remove combustible layers of woody debris and brush and other material that is accumulating in forested areas where fire has been suppressed and excluded. Sometimes these projects involve removing material from the forest floor. Sometimes they involve cutting down some trees to open up a forested canopy and reduce the likelihood of a wildfire spreading from crown to crown. And sometimes they include prescribed burns. We'll hear a lot more about fuel treatments in the next episode. I asked Gord about some of these projects in the Okanagan.
I think hats off to the Okanagan Shuswap District, who, applied for funding through us to do a lot of work, and primarily in the Southeast Kelowna area. And it's fit into the ministry's wildfire risk reduction program, which is, their own internal program that started after FESBC initiated these projects to continue that good work, because there's a lot of work that needs to happen in throughout the Okanagan.
Have you noticed a change in the way people perceive these projects? Like, are people able to see a kind of thinning project as, this is actually making my home a lot safer, from your time in Kelowna even? Through now?
I think people are pretty sensitive, and I hate to say it, but sometimes an event like 2003 makes it easier. The events of 17, 18, and 21 makes it easier for people to believe us. But that being said, there's definitely a need for that balance. We fund a project in the Joe Rich area. The area, I guess it would be southeast of Kelowna, on the highway towards Rock Creek. Gee, what year was that? 17, 18? Joe Rich had a significant fire of note. I think it was 400 to 600 hectares. That scared everybody there. The need for that a treatment in there was probably a change the perception of the people. That project came as an application to us, 17-18, somewhere in there. But I was involved with, the high risk concern of the Joe Rich area when I was in wildfire from 2009 to 2014. Difficult. What do you do there? And there's so much work to do that you kind of need the partnership of industry to do it. And then, maybe that's too much. None of these things can happen overnight, Judy. I guess that's the other, kind of thing is it takes time to get these things, the planet right, get it all done. I always encourage our industry partners to be part of our project, because you and me and everybody at BC, we can't afford to do all this. It's expensive for us all to do. We can't afford not to do it, but it's expensive for us to do, I guess is probably a better way to put it. And we need the assistance of our forest industry. One of the balancing acts of some of the projects that we have funded is in around the importance of your irrigation districts and the watershed groups in around the Okanagan. We've funded some planning and some treatments that either we have done or have been picked up by the Wildfire Risk Reduction Program by the province to recognize how important the watersheds are, not only for the public, but your agriculture industry in the Okanagan, right? I'm so excited and happy to see the importance of wildfires is and risk reduction is getting out in the public eye because it can be forgotten so quickly. I saw that in my career as a wildfires management specialist is if we didn't have a fire last year, nobody cared. All I care about is I'm going to go canoeing and camping and have a campfire. And all of a sudden we get smoked out. It's a really lousy summer. You know, Kamloops, I think Kelowna, same there. It wasn't, we got robbed of a summer. Right. And in so many different ways, either we knew somebody that was impacted from an evacuation or in my household, people had trouble breathing. Right. It was just one of those things. So, you know what? I think this is critical that we're getting this out in the public eye. And I think it's important to all of us who live near, in, around the wildfire urban interface, those who recreate in BC's forests, we all have a role and really in reducing the starts and supporting the activities that our leaders are actually want to get done to reduce the, you know, the likelihood of fire in your neighborhood. So that's the key thing for me.
Did you ever work on any fires in the Okanagan?
Yes. Yeah, of course. As a firefighter in British Columbia, that's like a rite of passage. There's fires in the Okanagan every season, right? It's just a eventuality, right? My name is Kelsey Winter. I work for the BC Wildfire Service in the province of British Columbia in Canada, and I'm also the chair of the BC Fire Smart Committee.
Do you have any stories from some of the first fires that you worked on?
I have quite a few stories. I'm trying to think of a good one. We got a report of a fire way, way up a Forest Service road. No helicopters. It's the middle of the fire season. There's more important targets elsewhere. We're probably on day 12 of working, so people are pretty tired. We drove up there regardless. It took us quite a while. This was not a very well-maintained FSR for a service road, so there was potholes that could sink your entire vehicle if you weren't careful. Got up to where it was, thankfully not a big hike from the Forest Service road, no water anywhere, and we're talking anywhere. A helicopter that was bucketing on another fire was able to come by and say, yeah, the best place to get water is way back down the road you just drove up on. And so we went all the way back down, filled up our tank, and then on the way up, got a flat tire. Oh my God. So we're perched on a super steep section of the road. Obviously can't change the tire without emptying the tank. So all of the water we just went and got, we dumped all over the road so that we could change the tire. Drove all the way back down. Thank goodness the fire was like in some pretty gnarly slash and some bigger growth. So it hadn't taken off because we were not very quick on our initial attack. But we did it. Went back down, got more water, drove all the way back. It was challenging. But that was one of my very first ones too. So I was like, are they all going to be like this? The one I think of the most, Smith Creek fire in the Okanagan. I was there with an incident management team. We were pretty sure we were going to lose neighborhoods. It's scary. It's a scary place to fight fire because it's so populated, right? And the fuel type there is not an easy one to stop when it's hot and dry and windy, right?
Is there anything that stands out to you from working in this valley?
I think for me, and in my job now too, as the Fire Smart program lead, the Okanagan for me is always like the litmus test is the wrong word, but if we're succeeding in the Okanagan, that's a really good indicator that we're succeeding because it's somewhere that's always going to be impacted by fire, somewhere that historically has had some of the worst fires that have really heavily impacted the populations. It's a tourist center. It's an economically a super important area of British Columbia. I think it's kind of where all of those things converge. And I one of the things with FireSmart that I say all the time, that everybody, I guess, that lives and breathes FireSmart does, is that it's not a disaster unless homes are involved. And in the Okanagan, homes are involved. You know, it's populated, there's people, everybody lives in the wildland urban interface.
Yeah. Can you think of any particular stories or projects that are happening in the Okanagan with FireSmart? I don't know if there's any like specific like place-based stories that you have of like doing this work in this area.
Yeah. In BC, our primary funding program for FireSmart is the Community Resiliency Investment Program, and it's run through UBCM, which is the Union of BC Municipalities. But basically, it provides up to $150,000 per community to do FireSmart work or fuel management work, which is amazing. And the eligible activities within that program, you know, you can do assessments, you can replace the cedar shake on your roof, you can make those small changes that can, you change bylaws, you know, create a position that's dedicated to FireSmart. There's a lot of cross train, so you get your fire department staff out with your wildfire staff and make sure that they know how to handle each other's equipment, that kind of thing. And the Okanagan has quite a few areas that have been involved in that grant funding for a long time. Penticton has probably one of the best FireSmart programs in British Columbia. They have a van that's a FireSmart van. They have community events. They have year-round positions. They have bylaws that are in place that enforce FireSmart principles if you live in Penticton. So they've really gone above and beyond. Kelowna is really involved in the program. They have the Home Partners program there, which is detailed mitigation assessment of individual homes. The homeowners are provided a report, and then they are able to go do those mitigation recommendations on their property. And then they get a certificate at the end that says you're a FireSmart property that they can then use for their insurance. So Kelowna is really involved. And I can't list all of them, but there's a ton of great areas in the Okanagan that have really adopted the program. And I think that's, like you were saying earlier, that's because of living in the Okanagan. They understand it's something that's always going to be there, right? There's a project that we started last year through the BC FireSmart Committee, and it's doing research in the wildland urban interface on structure ignition. So basically getting more data on why some structures ignite and why some don't. So when a wildfire moves through a community, why are there those? You see the pictures that, like, especially more out of the US, but even in Lytton, of those one house on that row that's still standing and the others that are gone. And I went to a couple fires this summer in the Okanagan with the research team. And it was crazy to see the little things like maintained green grass. So someone who just mowed their grass, you know, might make a huge difference, might be the reason why that house was still there and the one beside it was gone. Or things like all their lawn furniture was pulled away off their deck, or their deck was sheathed in. And so to me, being there and actually seeing those structures, the one that's just ash and all you can see is the, you know, bricks that were there on the chimney stack, everything else is gone next to the one that, you know, is still there. And that's some pretty powerful stuff. I was saying to the researchers, you're coming home and you're walking down your driveway and you have this idea of what's going to be at the end of your driveway. It would be so, I think, reassuring to a member of the public. And we talked to a few of them that were like, I did everything I could. Like when I left that house, when I was told to evacuate, it was FireSmart to the best of my abilities. Like I was confident leaving that house that I had given it the best chance I had of coming back to it, versus someone who was thinking, oh man, you know, the propane tank was right up against the house, or, you know, those little changes and the windows were open, or I think that was pretty powerful for me this summer, just seeing what people were going to end up coming home to, right? And what we can do as a program to encourage them to make those changes ahead of time, right? When they still have time to do it.
Thank you. And now once more the wind is blowing, and the fire surges upon the town and the countryside. The deer historic, what was lovely, the firs and the pines, etc. The brown rabbit hopping. The canyon road to the railway trestles, where we took our brother and our mother on a Sunday or a Wednesday, with its tall ears standing up. I would comfort if I could, but would have to wrestle it down and feel its scared heart pounding. A stubble of blackened shards where magpies fly, try to settle in autumn light. Pine sap looks blue against bark's carbonic crust. And a spray of brown needles on the forest floor we pretend are a carpet of grasses and not a scorch of tears upon the miles of roots that smolder still in molten maize, where a bluish haze appears to mark the transit of ghosts and giants who left an arsonist's hoard heaped, extinct matchsticks leaning tip to tip.
There must be some kind of way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There is too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along that line know what any bit is worth.
I'm curious to hear more about this homemaking in a fire-prone place. Can you say more about actually writing the fire and about how home and making a home in the Okanagan came through in the poem?
Yeah, I think my sense of being at home in the Okanagan at the time that I wrote that poem was still really new and fresh because we had more or less just moved there. And, you know, didn't know that many people here, except for June and David. And there's another little section of my little piece about that I call my friend June that I can read. Because for me, home is people, too. It isn't, you know, it isn't just my house. My memory of that time is as much about June as it is about the fire. I mean, the two events coincide so deeply in my memory of the time.
Sharon read from her essay, My Friend June, which is published in a collection called Locations of Grief. June got sick with cancer and passed away 2.5 years after she and Sharon lived through the Okanagan Mountain Park fire together. Sharon and I talked about the importance of her friendship with June. And Sharon told me about an event that she and June organized to bring people together after the fire.
So after the fire, June and I decided we should get some people together who all, because everybody had been, this entire city had been traumatized. And then we're just all kind of sitting there. So why don't we get some people together to talk about their experiences, share their experiences of the fire? I don't know why. Anyway, so we arranged this. Organized this and made posters and sold tickets and got on the phone. I phoned local helicopter company and asked if somebody would be willing to speak about being a helicopter pilot, putting out fires. And indeed, this one fellow did come and it was fascinating. Got Patrick Lane, who used to live in the Okanagan, wonderful poet who's living on Vancouver Island, but he came up and read. John Lent's quartet came and played, and the place was packed. And it was just a relief, you know, it was a relief to be with other people and talk about this and cry and everything. Yeah.
I keep thinking about what is powerful about poetry and art and literary work that has to do with fire, and why it's important to have a space for these kind of fire humanities reflections. And this kind of gathering that you organize seems to embody a lot of what feels powerful about it, like this ability to use language to notice together, and also the way that poetry can bring people together, and literature and music. Do you have other reflections on just kind of what the humanities have to offer and what poetry has to offer as in communities that are fire adapted and live with fire?
I think what writing does, and maybe poetry even more so, is it brings to life the particulars of an experience. Not just the generalities about it or some aspect of it, but actual real particular things, from particular feelings to particular objects to particular relationships, where there isn't this sense that, okay, if it's a poem about the fire, it has to be about the fire, and when the fire is just part of what's happening. So I think what poetry does is restore us to the real, restore us to who we are as feeling, perceiving, spiritual beings, and reminds us of the value of that. And that's not a trivial thing. Like I was saying earlier, what we care about is tremendously significant. And we have to keep remembering what we care about, because we're often misled by things that are impossible to care about. Who can care about an abstraction? Who can care about some general office language about this, that, or the other? Maybe the people working there need it to do whatever they have to do, but it's just an aspect. It isn't the fullness of the real. What we share are these particularities in our experience, and that's what holds us together. I don't know, it just seems that sometimes these terrible things happen. And so when we were together at the Rotary Center afterwards, we were together again as human beings who'd experienced a calamity and who had lost, some of us had lost a lot. But I think what is at risk is precisely that separation of home and people. I think when that happens, it's very hard to restore.
The Okanagan-based Lent Fraser Wall Trio played music at the gathering that Sharon and June organized in 2003. You've been hearing parts of their cover of Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower in this episode, used here with permission from John Lent. The rest of the music in this episode is from Blue Dot Sessions. You also heard a selection from Sharon Thiessen's poem, The Fire, in this episode, recorded for the digital edition of the poem created by UBC Honors English graduate Amy Thiessen. You can view the digital edition of the poem and hear Amy's interview with Sharon at sharonthiessenthefire.omica.net. In this episode, you've been listening to my conversations with Sharon Thiessen, Matthew Bourbonnais, Daryl Spencer, Dave Gill, Jeff Eustache, Gord Pratt, and Kelsey Winter. We spoke about living through severe wildfire events and about how to protect communities from wildfire danger.
You can get going today to prepare yourself and your home for wildfire events. And there's great information on the Fire Smart Canada website about this at firesmartcanada.ca. You can listen to many of my full recordings on my thesis project website, listening to firepodcast.ca. You can also find the transcripts of those interviews there and transcripts of each of these episodes. The episode transcripts include citations from my research. This research was supported in part by the Government of Canada's New Frontiers in Research Fund through UBC Okanagan's Living with Wildfire Project. I'm Judy Burr. Thanks for listening.